So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker of the morning session. This is Dr. Elizabeth Grubbs from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, an associate professor and a leading endocrine surgeon. And she's going to talk to us about some of the initial diagnostic issues relating to adrenal incidentaloma. Dr. Grubbs.
So good morning. I am going to talk to you a little bit of the initial evaluation of adrenal incidentalomas. I do not have any disclosures. So what, first of all, is an incidentaloma? Gwen talked a little bit about it. It's considered an adrenal lesion or a mass that is incidentally discovered during imaging that was not performed for suspected adrenal disease. So I was always taught that you call it a lesion when it's something that you don't want to resect, and you call it a mass when it's something you do want to resect. So just think about that. But the idea is it is during imaging that was not performed when you're thinking about anything related to the adrenal. So it isn't when you have suspicion for working up elevated catecholamines or you're doing a staging imaging for lung cancer. This is purely when it's for another reason other than the adrenal. And these are usually considered lesions that are 1 centimeter or larger, unless clinical stigma of adrenal hormone is identified after the lesion is detected. So how common is it? Well, prevalence is around about 2% that is found in autopsy studies, up to 4%, and that's more from the radiologic studies we have. And it can be upwards of 10% in the elderly. The majority of these incidentalomas are going to be benign and non-functioning. About 12% are going to be benign and functioning, and then the remaining are going to potentially be malignant processes, either primary adrenal carcinoma or a malignant metastatic carcinoma to the adrenal. However, if a patient already has a history of a cancer, that chance of it being a metastatic carcinoma can be upwards of 50%, especially if we're thinking about such diseases as lung and breast and renal. So we have to keep that in mind. So now let's talk a little bit more about that 12% of benign nodules that are functioning. We can't talk about the adrenal without at least reminding ourselves of the anatomy. Again, there is that outer three-level cortex that has the three zona in it, and that inner medulla. And when you look at that 12% of functioning adrenal adenomas, when we look at pooled analysis of data from the literature, about 5 to 8% of those hyperfunctioning adenomas are gonna be a cortisol in nature. Upwards of 5% can actually be pheochromocytoma from that medulla making those catecholamines. A tops 1% can be that aldosteronoma, and then very, very few adenomas secrete sex hormones. That is more reserved when we're thinking about carcinoma. So how do I approach an incidentaloma? Well, as with everything in this day and age, there are guidelines to help us. Again, we remember that guidelines aren't fast rules, but they are places that we can look for very thoughtful discussion of people that have taken a look and analyzed the literature. So there are four main guidelines that have been out over the past decade. The first is the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, ACE, and the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons that put out guidelines in 2009. The Italian Association of Medical Endocrinologists in 2011, the Canadian Urological Association in 2011, and then most recently the European Society of Endocrinology Clinical Practice Guidelines in association with NSAT released guidelines in 2016. So how do we approach this incidentaloma? Really the question that we need to ask ourselves, is this lesion high risk? Essentially, do I have to worry about it or can I just forget about it? So the two main things we need to think about when we are trying to decide whether it's high risk is, number one, is the lesion hyperfunctioning? And number two, what is the risk of malignancy? Let's talk first about hyperfunctioning. So all of the guidelines that I talked about agree that incidentalomas should be evaluated for glucocorticoid excess, mineral corticoid excess, and that catecholamine excess. So glucocorticoid is the first one we'll talk about, and this would be in the setting with incidentalomas of subclinical Cushing syndrome. Again, when we think about subclinical Cushing's, we're not thinking about patients that have the signs and symptoms already of cortisol hypersecretion. So we're not so people that already have hypertension, obesity, osteoporosis, diabetes, and then some of the symptoms that we associate with this, the moon facies, the dorsiclavicular and supraclavicular fat pads and central obesity, those might be folks that are more already have overt Cushing's. But here we're talking about screening for those patients that don't have any symptoms. All of the guidelines could agree on the consensus for initial screening in this group. Really, the low dose 1 milligram overnight dexamethasone suppression test is a great screening study. The idea is you take that medication in the at night and then have your labs check the next morning. We at our institution say try to stay up till 11 p.m., take your medication, and then have those labs drawn at 8 a.m. the next morning. So while there is agreement on the initial screening, there's less consensus in what actually makes a positive screening test among the guidelines. So the ACE and AES guidelines said any cortisol in the morning that is greater than 138 nanomoles per liter, that is considered a positive screening test for glucocorticoid excess. The other studies hedged a little bit and said, well, when you look at the data, we all can agree that if it's greater than 138, that it's a positive test, but we also think about it being a little bit lower to around 50 nanomoles. And certainly consider that lower edge of things if your patient has any potential signs and symptoms of having Cushing's. So the next thing that we have to consider evaluating for is mineralocorticoid excess. And this would be in the setting of hyperaldosteronemia and Kahn syndrome. So again, here the guidelines all can come together and agree that the plasma aldosterone concentration ratio with plasma renin activity is the appropriate initial screening study. With this test, the idea is go ahead and also do it in the morning, but do it after the patient has been up and moving for around 2 hours, and have them, when they come to get their labs drawn, be sitting upright for about 5 to 15 minutes is the ideal there. What makes a positive screening test in this setting? Again, some were able to come to an idea, others didn't touch it. ACE said if you have that ratio that's greater than 20, that's a positive screening test. The Italian group said more 30 to 50, and then the Canadians and Europeans didn't go there. We do know that the absolute plasma aldosterone level of greater than 15 or 20, depending on the study, does increase the specificity of the screening test. It is something that you can use. If you have a positive screening test, the idea is then you would go on to have a confirmatory test performed, either a saline suppression test or a 72-hour salt loading test to confirm this diagnosis. But this would be the right first initial test. Idea behind aldosteronomas then is if you have, after you do your primary test and then you do your screening or your confirmatory test, then you have to decide, well, I know I have high aldosterone, but is it related to a bilateral hyperplasia or is it really related to an aldosteronoma, a single lesion or mass within your adrenal that is hypersecreting that could potentially be addressed surgically. So the idea then is how do we make that determination? And that's where adrenal venous sampling comes in. The idea there is you cannulate the bilateral adrenal veins to determine which side, if there is a side that there is aldosterone excess. I can say that as one sentence that's very easy. It's much harder to do in actuality. To be able to cannulate the adrenal veins often takes a center that does this often. You have to go through steps of determining that you have successful cannulation of those adrenal veins by examining your cortisol within the adrenal versus within the IVC. You need a higher ratio there to determine that you're in the correct place so that you can even start the test. And then you have to determine the lateralization. Most often, we tend to use cosentropin stimulation to allow this test to be more easily performed. Successful catheterization, that is where the cosentropin is found to be most helpful in allowing this portion of the test. You want to have that ratio within the adrenal vein at least three times that of your peripheral cortisol level. And then lateralization, you have to do a cortisol-corrected ratio. You want one side to be at least 2.6 to 4 times the size of the other. And that ratio, that variation in that cutoff is also related to whether you're using Cosentropin Stim or not. So who should undergo this adrenal venous sampling? Because it is an invasive procedure. So an expert consensus statement was published in 2014. And the idea looking at the literature was that patients with established primary aldosteronoma should undergo AVS when adrenalectomy is considered. In cases, in all cases except when you have a patient that's under 40 with marked primary aldosteronism and a clear unilateral adrenal adenoma with a normal contralateral adrenal gland on imaging. Also, patients who are suspected of having an adrenocortical carcinoma don't have to undergo this. And then patients with proven familial hypertension 1 or 3. Otherwise, they do suggest that you undergo this lateralization. Again, this idea of trying to determine lateralization. Again, if adrenalectomy is considered, obviously the discussion first should be had that adrenalectomy is on the table. If not, for whatever reason, then this study is not necessary. Finally, we get to the medulla, that yolk of the adrenal, and we talk about screening for a catecholamine excess. The guidelines can agree on initial screening that you either do plasma-free metanephrines or urinary fractionated metanephrines. My asterisk there is for the seated versus supine, in that we know that if you come in and sit down and are sitting upright and have your metanephrines evaluated, there is the chance that you're going to have a higher chance for a false positive read, whereas the more ideal way to do it would be to have them come in, lie recumbent for 30 minutes, preferably with a needle in their vein, and then draw the labs. That is not always possible in the real world. So often what we do is say, let's come in and have the seated test first, because it's often drawn right along with the other incidentaloma labs, including the aldosterone that you need to be seated for and not supine. And then if they're positive after that, we take that subset population and have them come back and do the supine test. What makes a positive screening test here? Well, really only two of the guidelines wanted to weigh in on that, and they said that if it's the plasma level, you want it to be 3 to 4 times the reference range, and they agreed on that. And if it's urine, you want it over 1,800 in the setting of making sure you have an appropriate urine collection. One thing to remember when we're evaluating the plasma and urinary metanephrines, that there are common medications that can cause falsely elevated results that we just need to think about when we're interpreting. Tylenol is right up there as something that can cause it, especially in the plasma, and then others that you see there, tricyclic antidepressants and MAO inhibitors that you want to take a look at beforehand and consider that in your deliberations. One thing to think about, that if you do end up diagnosing this incidentaloma as a pheochromocytoma, that approximately 25 to 40% of pheochromocytomas are going to be associated with a germline pathogenic variant of a hereditary gene, and that this increases in patients that are younger, that have multifocal tumors, that have malignant disease, that have a family history of pheo, and that has a personal or family history consistent with a potential syndromic presentation. So because of this high percent finding, we do recommend that all patients diagnosed with a pheochromocytoma and a paraganglioma, which is the PGL portion here, should be engaged in a shared decision-making for genetic testing. So that needs to be considered. If you'd make that diagnosis, getting a genetic counselor involved, at least to have these discussions, is appropriate. Again, as you have some of these factors that are more positive, that might lend you more towards moving forward with testing, but certainly something to consider in all. So what is the chance if we have a patient that has completely normal testing on our screening that they're going to develop hormonal overproduction over the course in their future? A nice literature review showed that in about 1,100 patients that were followed for over a year, that about fewer than 2% developed hyperfunction in the future. And then in a single series that followed patients for over 5 years, upwards of 6% did develop hyperfunction, with cortisol overproduction being the most common occurrence. So because of this, then we have to ask the question, how long do I have to do this? How long do I have to follow this patient and perform a hormonal assessment? So this is where, again, we have to look at the guidelines, and we're given a nice menu to choose from. The ACE says up to 5 years. If you can do that annual screening until then, that would be appropriate. The Italians didn't even want to get into it. Canadians said at 4 years, and then the NSAT said no, unless you have new clinical signs or worsening comorbidities. We tend to right now follow the more conservative course, and we do follow these patients for 5 years with lab screening labs. So we've talked about the hyperfunctioning. So now let's talk a bit about the risk of malignancy in these patients. And this is Bill Young's New England Journal paper from 2007 gives us a great picture of this. The idea is, when you want to look at adrenal incidentalomas on imaging, you want to think about three things, really: the size, the features of that lesion, and then the growth pattern of them. So if we look at the first two categories, and we're looking at adenoma here versus carcinoma, size-wise, adenomas do tend to be smaller. They tend to be less than 3 centimeters in largest diameter, whereas adrenal cortical carcinomas tend to be larger. The shape of an adenoma tends to be round, whereas a carcinoma tends to be more irregular. The attenuation on unenhanced CT, adenomas tend to be lipid-rich. Their Hounsfield units tend to be less than 10, where adrenal cortical carcinomas tend to have Hounsfield units that are higher, greater than 10, and usually greater than 25. And when you talk about washout of on an adrenal protocol CT, you tend to have a fast washout on the adenoma with a slower washout on the carcinoma. We'll talk about that a bit more. And then the growth rate, as expected, a benign adenoma tends to be slow growing with less than a centimeter per year in growth, whereas an adrenal cortical carcinoma tends to be more rapid. So the idea behind that washout that I'm talking about is an adrenal protocol CT, which is triphasic. The idea of the phases is that you have first that unenhanced phase, and that's when you're looking at just the, when we talk about looking at the Hounsfield units in an unenhanced setting, that you want to see less than 10. You then have the IV contrast, and you re-image immediately, and you see the uptake of the contrast into the adrenals. And then you do a delayed view in 10 to 15 minutes to see what the washout is, how much of that contrast is still retained within the gland. So again, the idea is, on an unenhanced phase, if you have Hounsfield units less than 10, by definition, that's going to be an adenoma, a benign lesion. If you don't have that, and then you move forward with your adrenal protocol CT, you then need to look at your absolute and your relative percentage of washouts. If you have an absolute percentage washout of greater than 60%, that is highly suggestive of a cortical adenoma. And if you have a relative washout of greater than 40%, that is also highly suggestive. If you don't meet these requirements, then you get that diagnosis of a kind of an indeterminate nodule. You can't really say that this is a benign entity. So again, just briefly on the top row, again, when you go through the three phases, you see the pre-contrast with the lipid-rich adenoma, you get the uptake of the contrast, and then with the delay, you get the rapid washout of the adenoma, whereas you don't get that same washout of the carcinoma. It tends to hold on to the contrast longer. Size considerations is something we think about all the time with malignancy. We do know that there is high sensitivity for an adrenocortical carcinoma in masses that are greater than 4 centimeters, meaning most times adrenocortical carcinomas are going to be larger. However, there's a lower specificity for that, meaning that only a quarter of lesions greater than 4 centimeters are going to be malignant. So you have to take that into consideration. And indeed, when you look at studies that on the y-axis of the CT diameter, size-wise, and you look at adenomas versus carcinomas, you do see that carcinomas tend to be larger. We also have to keep in mind that not everything is an adenoma of the adrenal origin or a adrenocortical carcinoma. There are other things that can occur within the adrenal: myelolipomas, cysts, lymphomas, infection, hematomas, ganglioneuromas, and CAH are all things that we need to take into consideration and have some radiographic features that can help us. So, guideline consensus for initial screening: a non-contrast CT is perfect for that initial evaluation. The idea then is, if you have a non-contrast CT that has that less than 10 on your Hounsfield units, you can be done. No further testing is needed. You don't need to go get the fancy triphasic CT. However, if you do have on your non-contrast CT Hounsfield units that are greater than 10, you need to think about additional testing. The ACE AES says go ahead and get that adrenal protocol CT that has the three phases to it. The Italians agree with that, as do the Canadians. The Europeans say you can get that or go on to get an MRI or an FDG PET, and that can help you equally in their evaluation of the data. In talking about FDG PETs, most groups though think that really that the role of that imaging is most helpful if the patient has a past history of a cancer, because that's determining metastatic disease or malignant disease is where the PET is most helpful. And of course, how long do I have to keep doing this if I decide that I don't need to operate? Again, we get a nice variety of answers here. Most groups say you gotta have some follow-up, 3 to 6 months to a year for those benign lesions that had less than 10 on the Hounsfield or had that washout on the adrenal protocol CT. And ACE is really the ones that said gave us the when we can stop at a potentially 1 to 2 years. Indeterminate, I think those are the ones that you need to continue following. And certainly, they also give guidelines of when to perform surgery based on growth for these different lesions. Some say if you have within a half a centimeter to a centimeter growth within a year time, that's when you need to start having the conversation about the growth rate and removing it because of that concern of malignancy that we spoke about. So when is a biopsy necessary? That tends to be something that we don't do often. This was a very nice systematic review and meta-analysis looking at 32 studies of biopsies that were performed. They did find that the pooled rate of non-diagnostic biopsies was around 9%, so not trivial in this setting. Fortunately, the complication rate for the pooled analysis was around 2%. And what they found is that it is very it is sensitive and specific for determining a malignancy, less so for being able to determine ACC, and more so for being able to determine the metastatic lesion. So from this study, their recommendations, and ones that we agree at our institution, is biopsies should really be preserved, A, only if it's going to change what you do, which makes a huge amount of sense, but sometimes we don't always follow that. And B, really, if you're concerned, if you have a new diagnosis of an adrenal lesion in the setting of someone with metastatic disease, those are the main reasons in an incidentaloma you would use a biopsy. So in summary, most incidentalomas are benign and they're non-functioning. You do need to have that initial hormonal and radiographic evaluation, as we discussed. And the long-term follow-up, both by their hyperfunctioning status as well as imaging, is still to be determined, and further studies are needed. So thank you very much.